It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. They fought in the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, rode with the Buffalo Soldiers, and performed mission-critical tasks in World Wars I and II, Korea, Vietnam, and elsewhere. And in Iraq and Afghanistan, they performed tasks no man could successfully undertake, according to our next guest. The U.S. military employs what are known as female engagement teams to engage with local women to gather intelligence in the war in Afghanistan. We'll explore the history of these teams, the obstacles they face, and how important the intelligence they gather is to the military's combat missions. Are you a veteran of the Army's female engagement teams? What was your mission? Tell us about your experience. What questions do you have about how female soldiers contributed to military efforts in Afghanistan? Are you a female soldier or veteran? Tell us about your experience. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Eileen Rivers is a USA Today editor. She has produced several multimedia projects covering the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. She is a veteran of the U.S. Army and author of Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. Eileen, first of all, thank you for your service and welcome to the Morning Show.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me. I appreciate being here.
Tell us, what are female engagement teams and how did they get started?
Well, your introduction was great and spot on. Female engagement teams were groups of two to three women who attached to male infantry units, and they actually went out on frontline combat missions with men. They were there to frisk Afghan women, to collect anything that may have been hidden on them by insurgent groups, and also just to talk to them and to try to gather intelligence.
And now, go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask about another phrase or name in your book is Team Lioness. I was interested in that and curious about how that nickname got started.
Right. So Team Lioness was actually the first iteration of female engagement teams. This started by the Army in Iraq around 2003. It started because there were men on the ground who realized that by going into villages and by frisking women or trying to talk to women, they were really breaching these religious and cultural barriers. In highly religious Muslim communities, it's an affront for men who are not related to women, who don't know women, to try to talk to them, to try to touch them. And so the Army realized they were really turning what were friendly villages into potentially enemy villages. So they started Team Lioness, and that's really how the FET got started.
What did the local, or why did the local women often have more accurate information about, for example, the Taliban's recruiting and comings and goings?
Well, women in highly Muslim countries don't necessarily work. So while husbands are away all day, women are at home, they're observing what's happening in their community, and they were often the ones who saw the comings and goings of insurgent groups. They looked around and they saw their neighbors' kids, the sons, the young boys, getting recruited by insurgents. So they were ready to talk. They were really trying to protect their sons.
And I understand that when the Taliban would invade a community, they used women to hide information. How did they do that?
They did. So, they really caught on to the fact that the American military was trying to be religiously cognizant after they learned that these were religious breaches for men to interrogate and to frisk women. The Taliban started hiding information on women. There was a time period before Team Lioness started and before female engagement teams really kicked off where, the military thought, okay, we don't want to breach these cultural barriers. We don't want to turn friendly villages into enemy villages. So let's just stop using men to do this. And they hadn't quite realized that women could do the job. So there was a really big gap of a few years where they weren't doing anything with women. And the Taliban realized that. They started hiding things like cell phone SIM cards, maps, any kind of like written plans they had to attack certain bases or to do stuff in the U.S. And so women were really holding on to information that was vital to intelligence collection.
Eileen Rivers is a veteran of the United States Army and author of Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. Are you a veteran of the Army's female engagement teams? Share your story about the work that you did. Did you work in intelligence gathering while in the military or community engagement? What was that like? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. One of the things you also talk about are anchor points. What were the FET groups better suited, or why were the FET groups better suited to find the anchor points in a community?
To find the, what do you mean by anchor points? I'm not understanding anchor
points.
Well,
anchor points, according to your book, anchor points are local grievances that, if skillfully exploited, could maybe drive a wedge between the insurgents and the community. How'd you go about finding those, and how did you make use of them?
Oh, I see. So yeah, there certainly were, I mean, there was so much information that was gathered from women. So female engagement teams would often go into the homes of women, and they weren't just there to frisk them. They also did what's called relationship building. They would go in and just sit down and talk to women during the day while men were at work and have tea, and just kind of find out when, you know, insurgent groups were coming into villages, when they were going, what their patterns of movement were. And they ended up building trust, which is something that infantry units hadn't previously thought about or considered. Let's build relationships with local people to really understand what they want, what they need, how we can help them. And by doing that, they did, you're right, begin to build a wedge between local communities who may have been Taliban-leaning or who may have been more vulnerable to the Taliban, and insurgent or enemy forces who were coming in. And by building up that trust, they were able to say, okay, we can come back to your community, we can come back to your village, and we can continue to help you. And the more the American military did that, the more villages started to lean on the military instead of looking toward insurgent forces. And so they were able to kind of collect information and also drive the need for communities and villages to depend on or lean on insurgent forces.
And I also understand that the missions included conducting some classes.
Right. So the female engagement teams really had two very separate missions. There was the combat mission, where they would, you know, attach these infantry forces, go out on front lines, do all that, you know, frisking if they were out on, you know, a raid, for example. But then female engagement teams also had their own separate missions. Again, they were really trying to focus on nation building. They were helping women get microloans to start businesses. They were helping women develop skills like sewing and jewelry making, so that women could actually take goods to a local bazaar or make goods at home and have their husbands take them to a local bazaar, so they could sell that and then bring financial stability to their families. I mean, one thing that the military really learned was we can't just fight this with guns. Nation building is incredibly important. We need people to become financially stable, families to be financially stable, which then stabilizes villages and then makes people less vulnerable to Taliban recruitment. The Taliban really preys on poverty. The poorer you are, the more vulnerable you are to somebody coming along and saying, work with me, I'll help you make money, I'll improve your family.
Eileen Rivers is a veteran of the United States Army and author of Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. Our conversation with Eileen Rivers continues. Are you a veteran of the Army's female engagement team? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The U.S. military employs female engagement teams to engage with local women to gather intelligence in the war in Afghanistan. Eileen Rivers, author of Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan, takes us through the history of these teams, the obstacles they faced, and how important the intelligence they gather is to the military's combat mission. Eileen is a USA Today editor. She has produced several multimedia projects covering the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. She's a veteran of the U.S. Army and author of the book that we're talking about this hour, Beyond the Call. Are you a veteran of the Army's female engagement teams? What was your mission? Tell us about your experience. What questions do you have about how female soldiers contributed to military efforts in Afghanistan? And are you a female soldier or veteran? Tell us about your experiences. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. There was a time, Eileen Rivers, when women were not allowed to serve in combat roles in the military. Explain how big a barrier that was for FETs.
It was a huge barrier. They were really caught in this horrible catch-22 situation. I mean, the military was not initially officially recognizing that they were combat soldiers, yet they were using them to do all of the work that combat soldiers did and then some. And on top of that, I should note that women who became part of female engagement teams actually did that at the sacrifice of their official jobs, which made a difference when it came to things like promotion. So women were leaving what was their regular job, going to the front lines, serving in combat, not officially getting recognized for it, coming back home, trying to get promoted, and they didn't have any evaluation on their regular job because they hadn't been doing it. And an annual evaluation is really part of what is very key. It's not the only thing that's measured, but it certainly is one of the biggest things that are measured when it comes to getting promoted. So the fact that there was this barrier and that they weren't officially recognized as combat soldiers while they were doing all this work was very difficult for them, and really caught a lot of women in that Kevlar ceiling or that brass ceiling.
And they weren't getting any formal infantry training either, were they?
That's exactly right. Right. So in the beginning, they certainly weren't. Team Lioness, that group you asked about before, you know, they really went out there initially with no training. They had, you know, very rudimentary basic training, which everyone gets when they go into the military. But infantry training is a whole nother level of weapons training, of formation training, things that are vital to save your life. And so one of the women I interviewed who was on Team Lioness said, you know, we initially didn't know what we were doing. We went out there and, you know, if the men pulled their weapon, we pulled our weapon. If they hid behind a vehicle, we hid behind a vehicle. We tried our best to keep up with everything that they were doing, and still do our job to frisk women, and also, by the way, to try to shield and save women if we were caught in a firefight. So they were really scrambling hard to keep up, but still felt like they had this duty to perform, and they gladly went out there and did it.
Tell us about the Ramadi mission and how it shed light on the fact that women were already involved in combat.
Right. So the El Ramadi mission that you mentioned is really how Team Lioness got started. That was one of the very first missions that women went out on, and one of the bloodiest missions in Iraq. So there were three women that I focus on in the book who went on that mission. And they were Army, but they were attached to a Marine infantry unit. One of the women that I interviewed for that, Lieutenant Breeslow, she was really caught in the middle of this. And she said she heard the call to prayer. The streets suddenly got incredibly quiet. And all of a sudden, she saw insurgent groups, members of insurgent groups, just pop up on the tops of buildings everywhere and start firing all around her. And she just immediately... it was sort of like this surreal moment where she saw things happening around her. She saw people getting shot and falling around her. And she said she was kind of scared, but she wasn't scared. She had this sort of detached way of experiencing it all. And she was really worried about a younger service member that had come with her as part of the female engagement team, who was, you know, virtually straight out of high school, incredibly scared, and she was more concerned with finding her and then also with trying to shield other Afghan women from the firefight than she was about herself. She was just, you know, an incredibly brave woman. But, you know, that was one of the bloodiest attacks in Iraq, and there was a female engagement team there returning fire and getting caught in the mix with no training, as you mentioned.
So then how did the female engagement teams grow and become, as they did, essential to the missions in Iraq and Afghanistan?
So, you know, military forces started using female engagement teams more and more. And around 2010 or so, there was a directive, an international directive that was put out that any female engagement team that came out and attached to a unit had to be formally combat trained. And by the way, these teams were used not just by the United States, but by, you know, countries involved in Afghanistan from all over the world. So at one point, there were about 149 teams, and teams are 2 to 3 women, 149 teams in Afghanistan that were female engagement teams. So, you know, they grew at a tremendous rate because the military realized, you know what, these teams are vital for our mission. They're pulling a lot of intelligence that we can't pull. And then they're also providing, you know, this incredible nation-building service that we know is vital in terms of strengthening villages and making sure that, you know, people are financially stable enough to turn away from the Taliban.
And at this point, had the members of these female engagement teams start getting credit for combat service and recognition?
You know, it's interesting that there was recognition among the men that they were working with because they proved themselves over and over again. You know, men who were skeptical about what these women could do, and I tell this through Sheena Adams' story. When she attached to a particular unit, she had two other women with her, there were 3 women total. And initially the men were very skeptical and they didn't think that these women could handle it. And there's a story in the book about this guy taking these women on this, you know, horrific ruck march to see if they could if they could stand this test. And the ruck march was actually more difficult than what the men generally did. So there was skepticism at first on the ground among the enlisted men, and the women managed to quickly turn that around. But in terms of the military at large giving them credit, the military system giving them credit, because the structure was such that women weren't given credit for being in combat, initially, there wasn't a lot of credit given in ways that really counted in terms of a career changing after being in combat. So did women get medals sometimes when they returned from war? Sheena Adams certainly did. Johanna Hipp certainly did. She's Johanna Smoke in the book. She's Johanna Hipp now. She certainly got medals. But when it came to promotion, Sheena Adams is one of those women who came back and kind of became the poster child of the female engagement team, funnily enough, and she got caught in that Kevlar ceiling. She did not get promoted and, in fact, had to, you know, leave the Marines.
Hmm. Eileen Rivers is a veteran of the U.S. Army and author of Beyond the Call, 3 Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. You tell stories, and you've mentioned these 3 women, you tell the stories of 3 women in the U.S. military. You mentioned Sheena Adams. She was a mechanic in the Marines. How did she become part of an FET?
She had to fight really, really hard. You're right. She was a helicopter mechanic. She grew up in Hawaii, actually, always wanting to be in combat. She said that when she was a little kid, she dreamt of being in combat, just as a lot of young boys do. And the difference with her is that she never thought she'd be able to do it. So when she heard about female engagement teams, man, it was her mission to get out there. And she had, you know, kind of an off and on record of service. So she had been in the Marines before. She left the Marines because she really didn't. She got kind of bored. She wanted to try some other things. She was a civilian. She tried a few other things. Didn't like those. Joined the Marines again. And so she'd only been a helicopter mechanic for a short period of time when she heard about these female engagement teams. And she went to her command and said, I really want to do this. And they said, well, look, you haven't been here that long. We have a really strong mission as helicopter mechanics. They were in the process of getting rid of some of the old Vietnam-era helicopters and ushering in new ones. So they had a lot of work to do. And they initially said, no, we can't spare you. We're not going to let you do it. And in fact, her commander said, you know, I'm warning you that if you do this, it's going to be hard for you to get promoted. It's going to be hard for you to move out. He actually warned her before she went. And she said, I still want to do it. And so she said, I want to appeal. I want to appeal above you in the chain of command because I really want to do this. So, you know, it took her weeks of doing interviews, talking to people over and over again, really making the case for why female engagement teams were important and how she could be successful. And they finally said, okay, we're approving this and we're letting you, you know, go. And she actually became one of the most successful female engagement team leaders.
I want to hear more of Sheena's story. We need to go to a break here, and we'll come back and continue our conversation with Eileen Rivers, a veteran of the U.S. Army and author of Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. We'll be right back. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're talking with Eileen Rivers, an editor at USA Today who's produced several multimedia projects covering the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. She's also a veteran of the United States Army and author of Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. Are you a veteran of the Army's female engagement teams? What was your mission? Tell us about your experience. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Eileen, we were talking about Sheena Adams and her experience as a member of a female engagement team. What did things look like in Afghanistan in 2010 when she got involved?
Well, that actually ended up, I think she went over there in about September of 2010, and it ended up being one of the deadliest years in Afghanistan. She learned that afterward, and she said, you know what, that would not have stopped me from going. And, you know, I felt like all the, even much more so, everything she was doing on the ground, she felt was incredibly vital because of that.
She was in a convoy that hit an IED and then was fired on. Talk to us about how she and her fellow FET members were involved in that incident.
So they were going to a village to do what is called sort of a knock and greet. Female engagement teams were really vital for this as well. They wanted to gauge how U.S. military activity was doing, how it was improving villages or whether they needed to kind of adjust the mission to do something else in particular villages. And so women were really good, American military women were really good at knocking on doors and saying, hey, we want to find out how your family's doing. We want to find out what kind of presence that the insurgent groups have had in your area. And she said that, you know, they went out to this really remote village and everything was eerily quiet. The bazaar, which was, you know, normally filled with people, it may not have been overwhelmingly bustling, but, and especially in remote villages, sometimes bazaars could be kind of slow, but this one was eerily slow. She said that there was a woman who walked by and she tried to strike up a conversation with her, and the woman seemed incredibly nervous and just wouldn't stop to talk. And the more they walked into this village, the more they had the feeling that they were probably being watched and that there was probably an insurgent presence around them, which is why nothing was happening. Sometimes people get tipped off that, you know, an insurgent group may be preparing to bomb a particular bazaar or, you know, market. And so she said the deeper they got into this village, the odder it seemed. The platoon leader gave the directive to go back to the vehicles and let's get out of here. So they went back to their vehicles, and on the way out, her vehicle in this convoy of, I think, about five vehicles, her vehicle was hit by an IED. And she said that she remembers all of these, you know, boxes of magazines just toppling all over her, and she passed out.
And how did this incident then further illustrate to the military that women were really in combat?
Right. So that's a great point. I think incidents like this and several others where there were ambush attacks and where vehicles are hit by IEDs really prove that the front lines don't exist. And that if you're on a combat mission, wherever you are, You have to be prepared to take on gunfire, prepared to, you know, take on bombs. That IED blast actually ended up giving Sheena Adams traumatic brain injury. She's had multiple surgeries since she returned from Afghanistan, and she's actually preparing to have another one. And so, you know, women were vulnerable to attack just like men were, going out on routine missions where they didn't expect any attacks at all.
In your book, you tell the story of Jumla Abbas. She was in Kabul in the mid-90s. How did the city change and how did her life change as the Taliban took control?
Right. So Jamila and her family lived in Kabul. Her husband worked for the government. He was a high-ranking military officer. She was also a teacher, so she worked for the government as well. And their life is really this a story of trying to outpace insurgent groups. Initially, they were fleeing the Mujahideen. That's what brought her family to Kabul. They figured that it was safe. But as the Taliban was trying to take control of the of Afghanistan and wrestle it away from the Mujahideen, they started slowly invading the country. And their last effort, the last sort of thing that would let them know, hey, we've taken full control, is taking over Kabul. And so, unfortunately, you know, Jamila and her family were victims of that takeover, and they had to try to flee yet again. They lived in this neighborhood named McCroyan, which was kind of an upper echelon neighborhood for government workers. And so, you know, her family had to pack up, flee again. And they went to a very remote village further south, and the Mujahideen ended up catching up with them. So the Taliban and the Mujahideen were often wrestling for power in Afghanistan, especially in the 90s, before the Taliban fully took over the country. And so one day, this was a holiday, her husband was home from work because of the holiday, trying to spend time with the family. And he was attacked. He was attacked by three men who were members of the Mujahideen insurgent group. And he was actually killed in front of Jamila and her children. She had very young children at the time. I think her youngest was about 2 years old, and her oldest was probably 7 or 8. And, you know, when I interviewed her about that, she said that she felt incredibly guilty because her family was standing outside the home, like right in front of the front door, and these men came, grabbed her husband, and dragged him further away, but in the distance they could still see him. And they beheaded him, and her children saw the whole thing. And she was just immobile. She said, I could not move, and I knew I should have ushered my children into the home, and I didn't. And she still lives with that today. But she didn't, I should say, she did not let that moment defeat her. She, in fact, became a feminist and a freedom fighter throughout the country.
How did you come in contact with her?
I actually found her through Johanna. Johanna worked with Jamila very closely to actually help Jamila with those efforts. That goes back to that nation building we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. So Jamila ended up running a women's center. She helps women flee incredibly desperate and dangerous situations. Through that center, she helps to learn women to read and write. She helps women learn, you know, different skills that they can use to make money for their families. And when Johanna met her, the building had just been bombed. This women's center had been bombed by the Taliban. The Taliban is very familiar with Jamila. They know her work, and she's constantly under threat. The Women's Center has actually been bombed 3 times. One time she was actually inside the Women's Center and was injured. She was not killed, but she was gravely injured. And so, yeah, Johanna said, if you want to tell the story of an Afghan woman, you've got to talk to Jamila. And that's what I did. And she is just this incredibly strong woman and has such an inspiring story.
Tell us about Maria Rodriguez. I understand she was a U.S. military police officer. What was her mission in Afghanistan?
Well, part of what she did and the way she really connected with Afghan women, I think, was through training Afghan female police officers. So part of the mission for the FET was to train women, police women, to be able to take over and do the same work that the FET was doing when the FET leaves. So they really wanted to train women up to be able to make arrests, to be able to frisk Afghan women, find that critical intelligence that's needed to push out the Taliban. And so she Maria really fought hard to be able to get on the provincial governor's base every week to have conversations with the provincial governor and to find out where these female police officers were. That in and of itself was a difficult task initially, and it took her several conversations just to find them.
Why was that so difficult?
Well, there's certainly a very different approach that I think Afghan men have toward women. I mean, in their culture, women definitely take a back seat. And so along comes this major, Maria Rodriguez, who wants to fully participate in these meetings and ask questions and talk and be engaged. And initially she wasn't allowed to. So she was the only woman in these meetings with the provincial governor between the Afghan military and the American military. Maria was the only woman in the room. So they kind of pushed her off to a very secluded area within the room during these meetings. I mean, she sat far off on a sofa that was far away from the provincial governor. When she initially met the governor, he would not shake her hand. She really was this kind of mute person in the room that initially wasn't acknowledged. If she had a question, she had to ask it through her commanding officer. So she would take a piece of paper, write the question down on the piece of paper, fold it up, hand it to him, and he would ask it or work it into the conversation if he felt like it could work into the conversation. Sometimes her questions didn't get asked at all. And so, you know, every week she was saying, hey, when can we ask about the women? When can we ask about the women? And it took about 3 or 4 weeks for the question to come up. And then she finally got to speak.
And she also had to abide by strict cultural roles for women, including how she had to adjust what she wore.
She did. So all of that's a really good point. All of the female engagement team members wore a headscarf or head covering. And they talked about how this was really important, not just to follow the religious rules. And you're right, that was really important in the country. But it also helped them relate to Afghan women. They kind of used that to meet women where they were and say, hey, I understand the cultural importance of this to you. And so I want to do it so that you feel safe around me.
Okay. We will continue this conversation because I really want to get to how these Afghan police women reacted to all of this. That's a fascinating story. Eileen Rivers is a USA Today editor and is the author of Beyond the Call. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're having a conversation with Eileen Rivers, a veteran of the U.S. Army and author of Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. She's also a USA Today editor and has produced several multimedia projects covering the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Eileen, we were talking about Maria Rodriguez and her role in engaging with female Afghan police and continuing the work of these FET units then. You tell a story of what I believe is like her first meeting with one of these. Why these women in the Afghan police? Why were these women initially hesitant to trust Rodriguez?
Right. Yeah. Initially, they were scared. I mean, these women were, it turns out, after weeks and weeks of trying to find out where these women were, they were in the same building that Maria had been in, upstairs, kind of sequestered off in a small room. They weren't working. They weren't trained. Nobody was paying attention to them. And these are women, by the way, who had risked their lives to be there. Just working in Afghanistan in some villages can get a woman killed. Working as a police officer, this male-dominated field, definitely wasn't safe for women. And nobody paid attention to them. So when this American military woman knocks on the door and says, I want to talk to you, their first reaction was to be suspicious. Why is somebody coming up here? Why are they talking to us when they hadn't been before? We've been up here for a very long time. So they were kind of reluctant to interact because nobody had been talking to them. They were wondering what this was all about. One of the women thought that Maria was trying to collect information to report back to the governor about them for something negative. Excuse me.
So how did Maria then manage to establish trust with them, and was she able to work with them?
She was able to work with them. She developed a really strong bond with a couple of the women. And initially it was really hard. I think that first meeting, nobody said anything. They kind of just sat and looked at each other, and Maria kept making these small attempts to initiate conversation. One of the first questions she asked was, "What do you need? I want to provide for you whatever I can." And the reaction was, "We don't need anything." and that the next meeting was much the same. By the third meeting, one of the women on the female engagement team asked if the Afghan women had children. And all of a sudden, the women lit up. A lot of them had been away from their children for a really long time because in Afghanistan, police officers often live at police quarters during the week and go home on the weekends. For women, you know, lodging was tricky. Because they weren't used to having women there, but often women couldn't travel back and forth to their homes because, again, it was dangerous for them to work. So one of the women asked, "Do you have kids?" And that kind of started this, you know, amazing moment to bond and to talk, and they ended up showing each other pictures of their children, talking about recipes, what they cook for their kids. It just became this really strong bonding moment.
How did the U.S. military's own rules hinder the work of the FET teams?
Well, you know, it's funny. I often, as I was reporting, found this really ironic that women were in this country to try to help Afghan women and elevate their levels of equality. And often American military women didn't have equality themselves within their own ranks. So, you know, FET teams could not drive off of forward operating bases, for example, by themselves. They had to have a male present with them whenever they did that. So when it came to doing their own missions, especially early on in the female engagement team's development, often they were rejected. So they certainly weren't rejected when infantry units needed female engagement teams to attach to them to go on these combat missions. But when they'd come back and the FET teams would say, "Okay, now we want to do our own mission. We want to go into this village and, you know, talk to women and find out what they need. Find out, you know, how we can support them economically." Sometimes military would say, "Well, we can't afford to do that right now," or, "We don't have any vehicles for you to do that right now," or, "You know what, I'm not going to give you permission for that because, you know, we have a stronger need over here with the men, so just put that on hold for a second." So they definitely wanted the FET there, but, you know, they were often very selective about what they allow female engagement teams to do, while at the same time saying, "Well, you better fulfill your mission because that's why you're here." It was a really rough catch-22 situation for a lot of women.
How far has the military come in valuing and supporting the work of the FETs?
Well, I think they've come a long way. There was a time when, you know, the military, I think, made a horrible mistake, which was phasing out female engagement teams. Around 2012, you know, Sheena Adams was back home by then, and she was really trying hard to save female engagement teams. She knew that they were going to be phased out. The military was kind of thinking that their usefulness was kind of going by the wayside. They were planning on pulling out of Afghanistan. We know that that didn't necessarily happen the way they thought it would. And so they were thinking, "Well, we don't really need these teams." And Sheena Adams was just trying to write protocols so hard to save them and say, you know, FETs can go into other places. They can go into sub-Saharan African countries where there's this necessity for them because there are groups like Boko Haram and other insurgent forces that are still threatening women. There's a usefulness for them. And so, you know, FETs were phased out. And then around 2015, the military realized, "Oh, wait a minute. We do need them. There are units on the ground that are calling for FET teams, and these teams are no longer available." So because of that, they ended up reinstituting FET teams and actually making them stronger than ever with very specific pointed missions.
When you consider the work of women in the military, what have you seen and heard about what's the need for women?
About what's the need for women in the military in
yes.
general?
Yeah.
Well, thank goodness we've come a long way, and the military now recognizes women as, you know, full combat soldiers. And so I think there's a need for women to fulfill every single role that's available to them and that they have an interest in and that men can fulfill. I think we have, you know, a ways to go, but we've come an incredibly long way. There are women who have graduated from infantry basic training. There are women who have graduated from Ranger School. There are officers that are now getting rolled into, you know, combat command positions. So women are really now fully being recognized for everything that they can do, and they're doing it all.
What do you see as the next step here?
Well, I see the next step as one of getting those numbers up. You know, it's interesting that I had an event last night at the Women in Military Service for America Memorial. And during that event, I actually interviewed one of the women that I featured in the book, Johanna Hipp, to tell more of her story. And she made a really great point, which is that, you know, there's only about, 18% of the military as female, and we really need to get the numbers up, A, to show that women really are capable of fulfilling all those roles, and B, to really get more diversity in the military, and that will help tamp down on discrimination. Women are out there when everybody, men who are in the military, the general public, sees what women are capable of. That will help to really eliminate discrimination. But we've got to get those numbers up. We've got to get more women in there to fill those roles.
What about the Kevlar ceiling? Is that still a problem?
I think it probably is still a problem. I think, again, until we get you know, more women doing all these roles and showing that they can handle those higher ranks, both through the Kevlar ceiling and the brass ceiling, that have been previously cut off for them, it'll be less of a problem. But I think the system has changed in such a way that it's now possible for women to get there. They just need the opportunity.
All right, Eileen Rivers, thank you so much for this book and for spending this time with us this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Eileen Rivers is a USA Today editor. She's produced several multimedia projects covering the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. She's a veteran of the U.S. Army and author of Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.